Welcome, and thank you all for standing by. I'd like to remind the participants that their lines have been placed on a listen-only mode until today's question-and-answer session. Your conference call has been recorded. If you have objections, so please disconnect at this time, and I will be turning the conference call over to your first speaker, Ellen. Sir or ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and before we begin, I would like to remind the participants that if you have a video camera, if you'd turn it off during this webinar. As you know, we are recording the webinar, and we have muted all phones. We're also attempting to maintain confidentiality, so please omit your name and institution later when you're speaking. In terms of questions, we'll take your questions by phone at the end of the webinar. We're allotting about 15 minutes for questions, and we're also willing to stay an additional 15 or 20 minutes if questions continue. Note that phone questions will be assisted by the operator, who will come back and ask for them. Now, throughout the webinar, you're most welcome to write questions in the chat box, which should be at the bottom right-hand corner of your screen. We will try to address questions from the chat box as we go. And what we'll do is we'll copy the question into our chat box and send the question and the response to everyone. All the questions, whether they're by phone or by chat, will be included in the transcript of this webinar on the AASLE webpage and on informalscience.org. Those will not be available until approximately November 20th. Also, if you have a question that's very specific to your proposal idea, please consider asking a program officer via email later. So, good afternoon and welcome to the Advancing Informal STEM Learning AASLE webinar. AASLE is a program within the National Science Foundation's Directorate of Education and Human Resources, Division of Research on Learning in Formal and Informal Environments. How's that for a mouthful? So we are four program officers participating in today's webinar. I'm Ellen McCauley. Dennis Schatz is the other program officer conducting the webinar. And Wynn Jennings and Sandy Welch are monitoring and responding to the chat questions. Also, if at any time Dennis or I are speaking too slowly or too quickly, please let us know via chat. And I'm trying to change the slide. How's that going? Okay, let's try the other way to do this. All right. So the session agenda. This is our agenda for today. You'll notice that we'll be talking about the AASLE program overview and project types, how to prepare a competitive proposal, the review process and the merit review criteria. We have several slides on NSF programs and resources that you may be interested in, as well as informalscience.org. And those are for your review after the webinar. We have contact information and questions. Now, I do want to make a comment on contacting program officers. You will see in our solicitation and in several places that we list an alias, drlaasle@nsf.gov. We really encourage you to use this email address because we have a program officer. It's Al DeSena. He reads all those emails and then routes the email to the appropriate program officer. And in doing so, you are more likely to get the right program officer for your content area and a program officer who is available at the time to respond to your question. So we really encourage you to submit your questions or your proposal ideas to drlaasle@nsf.gov.
Okay, this is Dennis. I'm going to take over. Welcome to everybody. I'm going to give a quick overview of the AASLE program to begin with. For those of you who have been involved with programs a long time, it used to be ISE. It's now AASLE. And much of it is very similar to what it was before, the informal STEM learning, a little bit of change there from science to STEM, because we've been doing STEM for a long time. And we think learning is a lot better than just the word education, because learning is what people do in education. We think about it as something that happens to other people. The most important word on this change is advancing. The program is really looking at innovative projects that advance the field through building knowledge via innovative approaches in research. So this is something I would say to keep in mind. First of all, how is your proposal going to advance the field? So some important dates on the next slide. Some of you might be confused. It looks like we have two proposal deadlines this year in 2014. They're really for two different fiscal years, 2014, which is the January 14th, 2014 date coming up. But then we've moved up the deadline to November 14th. So that will be for 2015 funding. I should point out that while the webinar is helpful, it's really only advisory, and you should look at the solicitation closely, be careful, or read it carefully. It has all the details, and of course, as Ellen said, you should consider calling or emailing to the AZL email address. Oh, and now I'm going to turn it back to Ellen.
All right, so in terms of AZL solicitation revisions, we are not accepting preliminary proposals or letters of intent for FY14, fiscal year 14 or 15. The project types have changed somewhat, and we'll talk about those in a moment. All projects are now required to collect evidence to build knowledge and advance the field, and you can do that through research or evaluation and or evaluation. There are revised requirements for external review and evaluation, and there's a revised description for dissemination. We'll go through all of these changes in a moment.
So let me talk a little bit about AZL projects. I think it's important to keep in mind that NSF is a research and development agency. Consequently, it's important that in your proposals you build on the fundamental research in STEM education, development, literature, and practice that's out there. It's very important to show that you're building off what we already know, whether that's through the literature or projects that are happening around the country. It's critical to be thinking about diverse audiences and the STEM content, and that this is really for informal learning environments. The primary audience needs to be informal learners or in informal settings you can use formal schools as an audience, but it really should be a secondary audience, not as the primary audience. Third, back to this advancing the field. You need to be thinking about how the project is advancing the field through the development of innovative research, assessment, resources, models, and tools. And consequently, you need to have a rigorous research and development plan. So another three items to keep in mind. This really comes back to advancing the field, is we're really looking at knowledge generation, new models. It's good to be thinking about how does your proposal ask what is happening, to what extent, why, how, what works for whom, and under what circumstances. You'll see that exact wording in the solicitation. So this should be a driving element for your consideration. It's important to identify the learning outcomes that you expect. Not just the products, but what are the learning outcomes that are going to occur, and to closely link all of this to theories of practice to inform your plan.
We received a question at the last webinar about what research methodologies are acceptable. And in terms of research and evaluation, both qualitative and quantitative are allowable. What's important to us is that you make a case for why you're doing what you're doing and how your methods align with the questions and what you're trying to get to advance the field. So let's move on to project types. They have changed somewhat from the previous solicitation. What I want to focus on here is how we differentiate them. Excuse me. So, Pathways projects are designed for exploratory ideas, proof of concept, feasibility studies, anything that needs initial research or prototyping before the larger scale research or development project takes place. So in your Pathways projects, you're going to need to talk about what you're going to do, how it's going to advance the field, and be very explicit about what this proposal is leading to. A Pathways project is not supposed to be a small-scale, standalone project. It leads to something. All right. Next is research and service to practice. This is most closely aligned with our previous research project type. We wanted to be more explicit that research in AZL is really research with respect to how it improves and advances informal learning, the practice of informal learning. So, in research and service to practice, you have to have at the core of the project a compelling research question that has to do with practice, about how people learn, or about a specific learning environment. And this project type, you will spend most of your energy, effort, and probably funding around the research itself. So let me repeat again. Research and service to practice focuses on understanding and improving practice. Let me give you an example. If I'm developing an embedded assessment to use as part of a youth and community program, this would likely best fit in research and service to practice if the majority of time and effort it really is on the embedded assessment. So I may be developing this assessment to go along with an already funded program, or I may be looking to use this assessment across a variety of different programs that exist. And so my development effort and my research, my development effort is on the embedded assessment, which is a research tool or product. And so, again, if most of your energy is going to the research component, it is a research and service to practice project type. Now, let's talk about innovations and development. Innovations and development projects focus on and leverage the development of a product, a model, a tool, a resource in order to better understand and inform practice. Now, let's look at the difference between research and service to practice and innovations and development. In innovations and development, more effort and more resources will be invested in the iterative development of the product, like a game or a TV show, an exhibition. And through this iterative development, you will be doing either a smaller research project or an evaluation in order to generate knowledge about how that innovation in development advances the field. And let me say this again. If your knowledge-building component in innovations to development is research, include your rigorous research plan in the project design section of your proposal. If your knowledge-building component is through summative evaluation, you'll include that in your evaluation component of the proposal. Now, broad implementation. So this is similar to the previous solicitation. Key to know is you must have evidence that documents you have a successful program already that is ready for broader implementation. So you will expand the reach through age, geography, special interests, and then you will include a knowledge-building plan. Our final project type is conferences, symposia, and workshops. Again, your symposia, your conference, your workshop must align with AZL program goals. And there's one thing that you should be aware of. We have changed the requirement in terms of submission dates from last year. If you're requesting over $50,000, make sure to put in your proposal on a regular deadline, either January 14th or November 14th. If your proposal is for under $50,000, it can be submitted any time. In our last webinar, we asked, does it make a difference when you submit your under $50,000 proposal? It does not make a difference. We've just found that we can deal with our smaller proposals at regular intervals throughout the year, but we are committed to reviewing all proposals that require sufficient funds, a lot of funds at one time, because our funding is limited overall.
Okay, well, let's move on to some information suggestions for preparing and submitting your proposals. Before I actually start that, let me just give you a few statistics about how many awards we might make, just to give you a sense of the competition, so to speak. We have about $20 to $27 million for next year to fund new projects. We have a total of $47 million in the budget, but we have to continue to fund projects. So $20 to $27 million, and you can see the numbers on the screen there in terms of how many pathways, research, innovations, and development that we expect to fund. These are only estimates. We, you know, it depends on the quality of all the proposals. So those give you some good sense of a range. We also do some funding of EGERS, RAPIDS, and career awards. And I'm not going to say any more about that. You can find more information in the grant proposal guide about that if you're interested. So preparing and submitting a proposal, some key things to think about. Probably the most important one is submit early. As much as you think everything's going to go fine, you find that you didn't actually fill out one box and Fastlane rejects it. And if it doesn't get submitted by 5 p.m. on the deadline date, that's 5 p.m. local time, you'll find it gets rejected. So I can only say start early. Make sure you've answered or you filled out all the required sections. There's lots of things, and I will be going over that a little bit, but there's many different sections. You want to go in well ahead of time and make sure you're thinking about all of those things. If any section is missing, it'll be rejected by Fastlane, and you certainly will find that that's frustrating. You want to check the proposal. If you want to check the proposal for compliance, you can actually do that in Fastlane as you're working on it. And finally, let me mention the IRB, Institutional Review Board. All of our proposals require an Institutional Review Board letter. And the so you should start on that early. So a little bit on the project summary. This is the first thing you're going to find three different text boxes, one for the overview, one for intellectual merit, and one for broader impacts. Most important for us in the first sentence in both the title and in the overview, you should say what kind of proposal it is, pathways, research, et cetera. The overview describes the activity. This is the quick overview, so somebody reading that can get a sense of what kind of proposal you're putting in and what is the outcome, what's the products, and so on. Then the intellectual merit and broader impacts, this is a foundation-wide requirement, and you need to fill out those two boxes also. Let me talk a little bit about the project narrative.
Actually, I'm going to jump in here.
Okay, that's fine.
So, in terms of the project narrative, we are more prescriptive this year than we have been in the past, and I want to talk about two reasons why the program has chosen to do this. First, ours is a knowledge-building proposal program, and so to fully document your project, you need to consider all of these project components, and we actually ask you to label them and use this wording. What we found in the past is most of the proposals or many of the proposals have a strong narrative, but may be missing one or more of these pieces, and then the reviewers don't rate it well. So we're really trying to build capacity within the field and make sure everyone includes all of these sections. Now, you ask, where did we get these sections? Briefly, there is a new document, the Common Guidelines for Educational Research and Development. We, like the rest of EHR, is moving toward this document, and so we're trying to use common language across the division because many of you apply to various various programs within EHR. So with that, Dennis, I'll turn it back to you.
Okay, well, I'm going to look at the project rationale. What's most important to keep in mind is focusing on the importance of the goals or in the research. How is it innovative? How does it advance the field? And how does it build on prior research and practice? This is a critical part of the proposal. You can't just go in and talk about what you want to do. You need to have this as a rationale for why you should be doing it. One thing that's in here is that you have to discuss your prior NSF support. Don't worry too much if you haven't had NSF support before. That's fine. This really is only focused on getting people who have had work or had grants before and trying to understand what the quality of the work is and what kind of outcomes that they've had. Now, to project design, this is probably where people have the most fun, but you got to remember the rationale first. This is where you talk about the project deliverables. What are the learning outcomes? Again, it's learning outcomes, not just what am I producing, what are the products. Who are the public and private, public and or professional target audiences? How am I going to enhance broader participation by underrepresented populations? And then back to this, what is the project going to generate in terms of new knowledge, including the questions, methods, instruments, and analysis that's going to be used? You'll keep on hearing about this impact. We need to know more about the impact, the outcomes, what are we going to learn? I'll turn my page here. Dissemination plan. This probably is similar to what it has been in the past. This is how am I going to disseminate, and I'm going to say the products, which is one thing, but it's really the outcomes. It's what are we learning? What have you learned new that's going to advance the field, it's going to help other people to do a better job of what they're doing? So that dissemination is even more important than my exhibit's going to get out this way or my film's going to be seen by so many people. It's how do you communicate the learnings that you've gotten or been the outcomes of your project.
Okay. This is evaluation and external review. Stick with me for a moment. As many of you have noticed, it's this part of the solicitation that has changed most. And here's an overview. I'm going to start with an overview of the rationale for having evaluation and external review. And then I'm going to provide two examples, one example for research and one example for development. So here we go. Evaluation and external review processes are, one, to ensure that projects get rigorous input throughout the life of the project so that the research and development components of the project are actively improved. So that's one. The second is accountability. The federal government is funding you to enact a specific project. So we're asking you to provide evidence. Did you do what you said you were going to do? And what was the quality of your work? Three, we've been very clear and we repeat over and over, all projects must be knowledge building. They must advance the field, whether it is research serving as the knowledge building component, evaluation serving as the knowledge building component, or a hybrid of the two. We want to be clear that there are as many permutations as there are proposals of how you're going to build knowledge. What's most critical is that each PI team with practitioners and researchers figure out together what makes the most sense for their project goal and include a clear design and description of an evaluation and external review plan in their proposal. Let me correct one thing that I said. Each senior team must have practitioners, researchers, and or evaluators. So you need some kind of knowledge-building expertise, whether it's a researcher or evaluator, on your senior team along with practitioners, no matter what kind of proposal you're putting in. All right, so let's move to two examples. Let's say that you're proposing a project with a research component. You're going to need a mechanism to get independent, rigorous feedback with respect to how your theory aligns with your methods, to get reactions to the data you're collecting and how you're analyzing your data, as well as how you're interpreting your findings. This external feedback may take the form of an advisory board with researchers, evaluators, and practitioners, or it may take another form that specifically fits your project's needs. In any case, the goal is to make sure you're getting external feedback at multiple critical points in your project from people who can help you do a better job. Now, If your project is primarily a research project, you're also going to need external feedback, a short, coherent report about whether or not your project did what it said it was going to do and what the overall quality of the project was. This could be done by the same advisory board as you had giving you rigorous feedback all along the way. It could be done by part of the advisory board. It could be done by an evaluator. Or again, some other external process that specifically meets your project's needs. In any case, part three that we talked about before, the knowledge building component of your project will be the research results if you have a research component in your project. So let's move to a development example. Let's say you're proposing a project that has a significant development component. You will need a mechanism to get iterative feedback on the design and implementation of your product, your model, your resource or tool, starting at the conceptualization of the development component of your project and continuing throughout. This may include front-end evaluation, formative evaluation, etc. This may be done by an internal or an external evaluator or a team of advisors. Again, the goal is as you are developing your resource, your model, or tool, you're getting an iterative input process to improve the quality of your project. Second, you'll need a feedback component with respect to whether or not your project is meeting its goal and what the quality of the project is, and that needs to be from an external source. Finally, you need a knowledge-building component of your project. If your development project includes research, then your research outcomes are the knowledge-building component. If your project seeks to build knowledge through evaluation, you'll need a summative evaluation answering your knowledge-building questions, such as what works for whom or under what circumstances. Again, as all development projects are different, we ask that you think about the design of evaluation and external feedback that makes the most sense for your project.
And now we're going to move on to a much easier topic to discuss, the management plan. This is the place where you describe your leadership team, the PIs, co-PIs, senior personnel, and who's responsible for what. It's critical to have both somebody who's an expert in practice and somebody who's an expert in knowledge building to be part of this leadership, and describe how both the practitioner lead and the research evaluation knowledge building lead work together from the beginning of the project. Make sure you get, if you're one or the other, make sure you get the other person involved from the very beginning. And, of course, you need to go on and describe how the advisory group and other consultants work. So it's a management team and how they work together. Be sure to describe any collaborations. The management plan should have also communication schedules, milestones, timeline, that type of thing. Now, a quick note on supplementary documents. This is always somewhat confusing to people often. You can have a pretty well unlimited number of letters of commitments or cooperation. Those are important to have so that people believe that you can bring together the groups and the organizations you say you're going to work with. But some of the other summary documents that you may want to include are summaries of formative and summative evaluations from prior work. Notice that it has a two-page max for that. It's a challenge. Everybody says 15 pages. We can't do it all. Make sure that everything that you're going to deal with is talked about in the 15 pages. You can't say, and the evaluation plan is in the supplementary documents. You need to at least give the essence of what the evaluation plan or the research, whatever it is that you might want to put extra details on, are in the 15 pages. But there is an additional 5 pages that are allowed for logic models, series of actions, evaluation plans. And then if you have, you're building an exhibit, you've got sketches and so on, there is an additional 30 pages that it's allowed for the supplementary documents. You'll also note, and you won't get past Fastlane if you don't include a data management plan. That's a whole separate section. And if you have a postdoc, you put in a budget item for a postdoc, it will kick back your proposal unless you have a postdoc mentoring plan. And finally, the budget. It's hard to say exactly what this should be. I think the basic statement is at the top. It needs to be consistent with the level of work. Don't think you should have to ask for the maximum amount of money. Ask for the right amount for what you want to do. Some of the things that you'll see you might have questions about that I want to highlight. If you have a person who's hired for more than 2 months of salary, you have to indicate in the budget explanation that why this person should have more than 2 months worth of salary. It's a pretty simple thing to do, and we usually don't have any problem with it, but you do have to state why they have 2 months more than 2 months worth of salary. This really relates back to university funding, so a lot of people don't have to deal with that with ASL proposals. Finally, the indirect cost rate is set by your institution and the auditors and is non-negotiable. You can't say you're going to take less indirect rate. And finally, no cost sharing is allowed. You can't even talk about cost sharing, so don't worry about anything on the budget items that talk about cost sharing. You won't have to worry about that. And finally, just a few thoughts about ineligible expenses that you shouldn't include. Capital or operating expenses. Now, if you're building an exhibit or you've, that's probably the best thing, and you have capital materials to build the exhibit, that can be included. But this is thinking more about capital materials for your building or something of that sort. And you can see the rest, office equipment, vehicles, undergraduate tuition, and often gets asked. We do pay graduate tuition if they're graduate student tuition if they're an integral part of the program. We don't do paid advertising, but if you were developing advertising, we pay to have it developed, but we don't pay for you to place the advertising, and certainly don't do admission fees. So those are some key things to make sure you avoid, but I would say this comes back to the thing we said earlier. If you have any questions, you should make sure you touch base with a program officer. Make them your next best friend and get good advice from them.
All right, let's talk about the review process and the merit review criteria. So in terms of the proposal review process, we receive 400-plus proposals, most of them within the last week of the due date, and we divide those proposals into panels based on the content of the proposal. And then for each panel, we get a range of external experts, basically your peers, educational researchers, evaluators, educators, developers, and each proposal will receive 3 to 4 reviews. Each reviewer rates the proposal, and then this information goes to NSF as advisory with respect to what to fund. We then get all of the POs, the program officers, in a room. We review the highly ranked proposals. And then as we seek to balance our portfolio, so we're not funding only one part of the country or only one type of project, we end up with a set of proposals that we fund each year. Now, one thing that I think is really exciting about the National Science Foundation is that we are very clear about how we ask our reviewers to review your proposal. In January 2013, NSF announced we would have new review criteria, or at least new questions. So both intellectual merit and broader impacts, the two merit review criteria, now have 5 identical questions. What does that mean for you? What I would suggest is when you write your proposal, you think about these questions, and then when you've got a draft, hand it to one of your colleagues who is familiar with informal science education but not necessarily your proposal, and ask them to review your proposal based on these merit review criteria. Again, the National Science Foundation is trying to be very transparent about how we review your proposal so you can do a better job writing your proposal and get more well, hopefully you'll be funded. But if not, you'll get reviews that will help you write a stronger revision if you choose to do so. So now we're going to I want to mention the Common Guidelines for Education, Research, and Development. I mentioned them previously in in terms of why we have chosen some of the language in outlining the narrative. We have included links to this document. But why even consider the common guidelines? We want you to know about it because it has influenced this solicitation, but even more so, it will be highly influenced our next solicitation. So instead of waiting until 2015 to let you know about this, we are doing so now so you'll have a chance to read it. The goals of the Common Guidelines Project is really to improve the quality and the pace at which we improve the quality of research and development in education. And this document was put together both by the National Science Foundation and the Department of Education. If you're interested in learning more about this, it will be covered in Webinar 102, which are on November 21st and December 3rd. Please register in advance. And while I'm talking about the Webinar 102, other things that will be talked about is more insight into external evaluation and feedback, as well as going deeper into the questions that have come out of these webinars, as well as questions we're getting on the DRL ASL at NSF.gov site. Now, as you're preparing proposals, I can't stress enough how helpful informalscience.org is. I'm not going to go through where to get all the information. It's on the slide, and these will be available by November 20th. But informalscience.org has a page that is dedicated to NSF ASL. It also has resources for working with evaluators. And finally, when we talk about learning outcomes, and Dennis mentioned, your proposal needs to talk about not just the product, but the learning outcomes that you expect. In the reference section of our solicitation, but then also the full documents are found on informalscience.org, are the recent reports from informal science researchers and practitioners that really outline the kind of learning outcomes that are currently being discussed in our field. So they're on informalscience.org. They're cited in our solicitation. We hope that you will use them. Other resources are NSF resources for PIs. If you want to know what's been previously funded, if you have questions, I would encourage you to read the grant proposal guide. It's a relatively long document, but not as long as how to manage your awarded proposal, which is an even longer document. But give it a look; it will answer a lot of your questions. And we're getting a lot of IRB questions on the chat, so I'm going to go ahead and answer that because we do have IRB listed on this slide. In terms of IRB, we cannot award you a grant without an IRB letter in place. So we've gotten several questions. Do you have to have your IRB prepared in terms at submission? No, you don't have to have it prepared at submission. However, you'll need to be thinking about it. So if we come to you later in the year and say, we are looking at your proposal in terms of funding it, you'll need to be far enough along that you can get IRB approval before we make the award. Any comments on that?
Well, and so keep a timeline in that. Typical around June, you know, summertime, we start talking with people about awards, and no later than the end of like mid-September, we actually need that award. So you need to be able to get an IRB letter. Sorry, we need the IRB letter. You need to have it done within a 6 week period of time. So keep that in mind.
And hopefully that answered about four questions off of chat.
Final suggestions. Okay, this one should be in all caps and very bold. Submit early. You don't have to submit 10 days early, but start a couple days. You can put in pieces at a time, and especially the easy things, the prior the pending awards, things like that. Get those things in early so you don't have to run into any problems. Please spell check. Make sure grammar and punctuation. There's nothing like a poorly punctuated proposal to have panelists say, well, if they can't write a good proposal, what does that mean about them carrying out an appropriate award? Back to making program officer your next best friend, be sure that you take the opportunity to connect with program officers. Use that DRL, azl@nsf.gov, to link up to the right program officers. We highly encourage it. We think it's really important. And before we end, almost end anyway, I do want to put in a plug. We're always interested in people who want to serve as a reviewer. Typically, we don't. People who are PIs and co-PIs, we decide that we shouldn't, or PIs or co-PIs on a submitted proposal, we don't tend to choose them, but there are other people beyond that we'd like to get as part of this process. So please send your interest to drlazel@nsf.gov. And finally, just a couple of words about other programs. There's not only the AZL program as part of the Division on Research and Learning. There are our ITEST program, the DRK-12, our EHR core. I'm not going to spend much time on these. As you'll see, they'll be on the PowerPoints when you get them. There's PRIME and REAL and CAREER and ATD. We could go on with more acronyms if you'd like, but we won't. But do take a look at them and see if they fit your program.
Okay, so thank you all. We are going to start with questions off of chat, and then we will take questions by phone. So, we just got a question. There's a couple that I'm ready to take. There's a budget preparation question. Is there more info other than on page 9 of the solicitation about preparing your budget? Yes. Go back to the slide that that talks about the link to the grant proposal guide. There is great. There's a lot of information on preparing your budget. I would highly suggest you go to the budget section of the grant proposal guide.
Another question was, must conference proposals spend 10% of their budget on evaluation? Well, first of all, there is no guidelines in general about how much needs to be spent on evaluation. It should be the right amount to get the information you need to be able to demonstrate success of your program to identify the outcomes. So I'll leave it at that. You have to decide how much to put in there in order to understand the success of your project.
Another question is, do theoretical frameworks that form the basis of the project have to be limited to informal learning, or can they be expanded or taken from communication and media frameworks or formal education frameworks? Absolutely. The theoretical framework that you are using needs to fit your project. The whole project then needs to advance the field of informal science education, but you are not limited to what informal science education does now. That's the whole key of what we do here. It's advancing the field. So please do.
Another question about, is a career mentoring program for minority students appropriate as an innovative and development project? Of course, we don't know the details of it, but just from that statement, it does seem like it would be appropriate. And I would write up a one-page summary of it and send it off to get input from a program officer. Just knowing what, since it deals with careers, the other program you should look at is ITEST, I-T-E-S-T, all caps, because that one sounds like it is a workforce development focus, and so that sort of career mentoring might be quite appropriate for it.
I want to add something to that. The ITEST solicitation for this year has not yet been released. It is coming. So when you look up ITEST, I-T-E-S-T, on the NSF webpage, you'll see last year's solicitation. It's worth reading last year's solicitation, but a new solicitation is coming soon.
There's just one quick question here. It says, will the November 14th be a permanent due date in the future? Nothing's permanent at the National Science Foundation. I could watch what I'm saying. So it is for this year, but what it'll be the next 2 years after that, we hope we'll have a two-year solicitation. Certainly, it's around the end of the year, either before January 1st or a little bit after.
The next question, cost sharing. Now I'm confused. You mean organizations can't help pay for parts of the project? So let's be clear. In terms of the budget page, you may list no cost sharing. NSF does not require, and in fact, it is illegal to put anything. We will have to return your proposal without review if you put anything in the cost sharing line. That said, we know that some of your proposals are bigger than what NSF funds. None of that information can be put in the NSF narrative, the narrative section. You may indicate that additional funds that are needed to make the project, to fulfill the whole project, that a line like that can be put in the facilities and equipment additional page, a separate section. It's not part of your narrative. You can put it there, but include no numbers. I hope that helps answer your question. I would also say, please go to the grant proposal guide. It will provide explicit information and the grant proposal guide is better than anything. If it's a question of what we say or the grant proposal guide always wins out.
Okay, another one. Are educational field trips during school hours considered formal? There is this gray area between informal and formal, and where do they fit? I think the best way to think about this is who's the target audience and for what purpose? So it could be school groups, but if the purpose is really to make sure that students do better in Algebra 1, so it's really focused on improvement in formal school learning, then it's probably better for DRK 12. But certainly, if you're working with schools and it has a strong informal out-of-school working at home, that's a very reasonable thing to include. Again, I would write something up and then give it to a program officer to really, because we're talking in the abstract here to some extent, give it to a program officer to look at in more detail.
So we're going to give Sandy Welch and Wynn Jennings a break right now. They're writing down all the questions from chat. Let's see if we have any questions by phone, and we'll continue to answer questions by chat. But let's if the operator could come in, that would be helpful.
Okay, thank you. At this time, if anyone does have a question or comment, please press star followed by one at this time. Again, that is star one on your touch-tone phone for any questions or comments. I'll take just a moment for that, please.
While we're waiting for the first question, I'm going to answer one more. If a research and service to practice proposal has some programmatic activities, can you request funding for those? Yes, you may. The key in between, differentiating research and service to practice and innovations and development really is where you're putting most of your efforts, most of your time, most of your money. It's all within a continuum. So you're welcome to email a one-pager to program officers. Also, use your best judgment and ask for what you need to make the program successful. Do we have a question from by the phone?
I do have questions. I do have a question from 14419. Your line is open.
Just a quick question. Because our email systems are down today, can you tell us where we go to? I've been on your website today while you've been doing the webinar, and I cannot locate where the subsequent webinars will be and how to register for them.
Okay, if you're looking for our subsequent webinars, the easiest way to do it is to go to nsf.gov and scroll down, and you'll see a section called events. Then you can scroll down on the events. The next 101 is on November 12th, 102 is on November 21st, another 102 is on December 3rd. But if you click on any of those, including the announcement for today's webinar, you will you'll go to the page. Or go to informalscience.org, scroll down to events, and the link is right there.
Great. Thank you.
We're ready for the next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from 14213. Your line is open.
Yeah, thank you. When the impact framework came out some years ago in a publication, it was an enormously helpful tool for planning not just the project but the evaluation. And I'm aware as well that it was tied to the, I don't know what to call it, but when people go online to report how well they're doing and achieving their impacts. What is the status of the impact framework now?
Okay, so you're talking about the frameworks for impacts of informal science learning. That document is listed in our reference section. It is also those five impacts which are awareness, knowledge, skills, behavior, and other. I think I've got those right. Those are listed in our solicitation. Since those frameworks have come out, that other has expanded somewhat with additional research documents, many of them coming from the national academies. So in terms of, do we still ask you to document your learning outcomes? Absolutely. That's what Dennis mentioned and I mentioned as well. The frameworks document is a great place to start. We also, in terms of the online program management system, we're still organized around those learning outcomes. They have been expanded, however, and if I can turn to the right page very quickly, actually, I'm going to go up in slide sorter. I can read you some of the other outcomes that are now common in informal science education documents. I'm going to guess it's this slide. No. Okay. So let me just ad lib. Some of the other documents, many of them are NRC reports, but some of the other learning outcomes now are identity, motivation was a previous one, 21st century skills, and the like. Oh, persistence.
Persistence.
Yeah. Yes, we're still very much in line with learning outcomes. The frameworks document is very useful. Thank you.
We have the next caller.
Thank you. Our next question comes from 14421. Your line is open.
Hello. You may have addressed this while I was holding to answer the question, excuse me, to ask the question, but I have colleagues who participated in the previous webinar and came away with the understanding that everybody was being encouraged to submit a one- or two-page summary of their project to the main ISIL address for feedback from program officers. And I was wondering if you could discuss that a little bit more.
Sure. We certainly encourage you to contact the program officer, and if you're interested in getting that feedback, you should do exactly what that person said. Send in a one- to two-page and we will distribute that, and any program officer will get back to you.
That said, you don't have to. Like we said at the very top of this webinar, it is not required to submit. In fact, we aren't taking preliminary proposals or letters of intent. So if you want feedback, you're welcome to send a one- to two-page proposal, free proposal. But most people actually don't. It's up to you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, and I'm showing no further questions at this time.
We have some more here that I will go through that came on the chat. One is, can a project be targeted to adults, or I think this is adult professionals, I assume professionals in the field, and definitely we have a number of projects that have been funded that serve informal science education professionals, so that's quite appropriate. Another one was, can you include partner costs in the budget? And I'm assuming this means can partners get some of the money that you get from the award? And yes, if they're an integral part of the project and they're doing services and there's costs of staff, equipment, whatever it might be, then you can put that into the budget.
Okay, and so there are several questions that have to do with research and evaluation. And I'm going to try to answer them all together. First, does NSF have a clear definition of research versus evaluation? Absolutely not. We try not to dictate to the field definitions or even where fields should go. We take our lead in many ways from the field itself. And as many of you know who work with evaluators, many evaluators use research methods. And so research, we ask that you identify what questions you are trying to ask and how you can reasonably answer them. And that may include research methods, evaluation methods, a combination of the two, evaluators doing research. Again, we would encourage you not to get so hung up on the language, because as a field and as a field of education, there's not a good definition. More important is that you identify what kind of knowledge building you're going to do and how you're going to do it, as well as how you're going to document that your project did what it said it was going to do and what the quality was. So keep asking if that's not clear. Another aspect, if I can continue with evaluation for just a moment, please clarify the role of research and evaluation in innovation for development. Well, in innovation for development, you're going to need some kind of iterative process to inform your development process. So that might be an internal evaluator, it may be an external evaluator, it may be a researcher. Typically it's evaluators, but again, there's that continuum. But you need someone or an advisory board of some kind providing you feedback, formative, front-end, et cetera.
So the question said to clarify the distinction between research and evaluation. So Ellen talked very well about evaluation. If you have a research question that's also part of it, then you will want to look at a researcher and a research design. But it's not required that you have a research component to your innovations and development. You could be doing all your knowledge building through an evaluation.
So let's say that you're doing your innovation in development has a development project and it has a research project. You'll probably need an evaluator and a researcher. That's the nature of your project. Again, do what your project most needs.
Question I have here: are there some STEM topics higher importance than others? No, we have we have talked about having target areas, target subjects, or populations, and so on. But we've decided that that should be something that's left open for the field to emphasize, so we do not have topics that are of higher importance. And while I have the floor, it says, can you include in-kind costs for partners? In-kind costs are considered a cost share, so they cannot be identified. You can certainly, as Ellen said, note that partners are participating at no expense to the. But you can't put a dollar amount. The big thing about this, not including any sort of cost share, is you can't put any dollar amounts in.
Another evaluation question. Under what circumstances can an internal advisory board replace an external evaluator? When we went through the three components, in terms of what was the quality, did you do what you said you were going to do and what was the quality? That part has to be external, and I think that's what everything else can be internal or external depending on your needs.
One more that I have, it says, can you submit small project proposals, budget less than $50,000? Well, we certainly have the conferences we talked about that are $50,000, but let's say you were doing a pathway or any other project, you can certainly have them that small. The biggest thing is the budget needs to be in line with what you plan to do. And, of course, we're sitting here looking for projects that will advance the field, and you'd have to really argue how that project is going to advance the field and be at less than $50,000.
Actually, solicitation's different this year.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, so let's if you can take us back to any of the project pages, project type pages, it doesn't matter. They're close to the front. You'll see that we do have a range. We've gotten enough questions about this that for all the project types, we have a range. So I think for pathways, it's up to $250,000. I think that's the number. Again, look at your solicitation. But for broad implementation, there is a designated range, and it needs to be within that range. Were you able to bring one of the ones? Okay. So Wynn's going to bring a couple up. We're going to continue to ask questions. But you'll see that there is a range, and it's listed in the solicitation. There's a question about the learning science and informal environment that came out from the NRC. Are those strands still important? And I think that goes back to the question the caller asked in terms of learning outcomes. Yes, just like the framework, that document is important. Are there any questions from the phone?
Yes, I do have a question from 1626. Your line is open.
Thank you. I had a question about the eligibility of organizations to apply. particularly in the case of small nonprofits. We've had the experience before that we went through the whole review, and not just our organization, but other organizations where we went through the whole review, got favorably reviewed, and then basically we got a sort of somewhat opaque notification saying that for budgetary reasons the proposal was declined. So can you provide me insight into that? Is it better to go in with a university, or how does that work?
Do you know, when you say for budgetary reason, that was because we didn't have the funding, or that someone said that your ability to manage a project was not
the latter. The latter, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I think this is something that you need to consider. This is something, so we deal with program and the fiscal. Division of Grants and Administration deals with the fiscal end. We deal with the programmatic end. The fiscal person from the fiscal office from the Division of Grants and Administration dealt with that, it would be good to talk with them and find out some of the issues.
We've been unable to communicate with them after repeated attempts, so I guess I was trying to figure out if you could provide me any insight about how to proceed, or whether we should just, you know, do a co-sponsorship with the university or something like that.
Yeah, certainly what we have found that people do, you can try and pursue it if it becomes important to you to be the lead agency. But if you if we find that lots of people who have had this issue have found a larger partner that has a track record with NSF and have had them be the fiscal agent, and they've become a program of that larger organization.
Okay, thank you.
Are there more questions?
I do have another question from 1615. Your line is open.
Hi. Thanks for this webinar and for taking my questions. I was wondering if it's a requirement for our project to serve underrepresented minorities?
Can you repeat the question?
I was wondering if it's a requirement of the project to serve underrepresented minorities.
So I think the solicitation is pretty clear on this. NSF has a strong commitment to underrepresented groups or individuals from underrepresented groups, and it also includes individuals from underserved groups. So while it is not a requirement for every project, it is highly encouraged, and it's one of the things, it is something that many of the ASL proposals include. So it's not required. If it doesn't fit your project, it doesn't fit your project. However, it is one of our commitments overall. Is there another question on the phone?
I do. I have a question from 11113. Your line is open. Please check your mute button. Yes, your line is open at this time. Do I have Paul online? Your line is open.
Hello, can you hear me?
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, the question I have is regarding reviewers and reviews. So if you had a review, PI had a review in 2013, if they resubmit in 2014, will they get the same reviewers as 2013? And if not, the new reviewers, will they have access to the old 2013 review?
The answer is no on both of those. It's likely that it will go to a – it may not even have the same program officer. It could go to another panel, and the panelists will not know – will not have any information about the prior award.
And, in fact, unless you mention in your proposal that this is a resubmission, the panel will not know that. Wynn Jennings, another program officer, is moving from chat and would like to respond to a previous – question with respect to underrepresented and underserved audiences. Wynn?
Right. Underserved has become a much broader term now. It includes the the typical underserved and underrepresented minorities, et cetera. But you don't forget disabled individuals, and also rural residents are now regarded as being underserved. So it broadens out that area considerably.
I have another question that came over the chat. It said, since the solicitation is so different, how relevant are prior funded work? I think it's not the funded work may be different than what might apply for the solicitation now, but it certainly demonstrates the ability of an organization or a PI to do the work and shows their competency. So it's still a very important thing to talk about.
So Wynn and Sandy have just indicated that for some reason the chat has gone down, and you actually may not be able to see the website. So if you cannot, that's okay. We are still on the phone with you, and we have a couple more questions to get through that did come through on chat, but please do not submit any additional chat questions at this time. So.
Want to go to the phone?
Oh, yes, please.
Oh, are there any more on the phone? Any more questions on the phone? Hello?
I'm showing no other questions on the phone lines at this
no
time.
Sorry. No. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Okay, so we have two more questions that are from chat when it was still working. Is there a limit on equipment that can be purchased? For example, equipment is part of a museum exhibition. There are a variety of different rules on this. I would actually ask you to go to the grant proposal guide for this question, unless, Dennis, you have...
Yeah, I come from the museum. In general, if it's for an exhibition, it's the computers that go in an exhibition, it's some of the structures that go around it, that is included because it's part of the project. If you needed computers for the two people working on the program, that's not appropriate. If you have an outreach program and you plan to, you'd like to purchase a van for an outreach program, that would not be appropriate because you could lease a van. There's a lot of other ways in which to do it. But the equipment that might go into the van to go out and do an outreach program would be appropriate. So, again, if you get down to the point that you're really asking specific questions about a specific item, then you should get back to a program officer.
Final question that we have from chat is, if project costs more than the NSF maximum funding level, how will reviewers look at this and discuss it with no overall understanding of the total budget? In designing your project, you should be asking for some component or some aspect that you can make a budget justification for. So we may not have the total picture, but it needs to make sense. And there needs to be alignment between what you are saying you're going to do and what your budget is. That said, Sandy, do you have any additional comments in that regard?
Well, this is sometimes the case with media projects like giant screen films that are very expensive, way beyond the $3 million that NSF provides. So this is new. As the caller probably knows, in the past we have actually required the PI to tell us the total budget, and that helped reviewers. But we're operating under a different policy at NSF. So I just would repeat what Ellen would say. So if it is a large scale project, you can certainly indicate it's going to be large scale. You can indicate you will be seeking money from a variety of sources, but you would say for the $2.5 million or $3 million we're requesting from NSF, we would do X. We would develop the project to a certain point of script development. We would be shooting. We would have maybe out of the 12 segments or deliverables, we are going to have 6 of those done. We will have other kinds of corollary educational activities. Maybe that's a better example. We would have a full-fledged educational outreach component that NSF could be paying for while we're are going to continue to raise funds for a broader, more comprehensive project. I know this is going to be challenging for those large-scale projects, but again, you know, you can call one of us when you have that situation, and we will help you think through it in terms of the best way to present it, just so you don't get caught up in this no-cost share issue or total budget issue.
So at this point, it is 1:15.
Excuse me, we do have a question from the phone line if you'd like to take it.
We will take it. Thank
you. Okay, thank you. Or 16216, your line is open.
Yes, thank you. I'm sure this is a big, really big question with a long answer, but is there an easy way you can tell me how underserved and underrepresented are defined?
In general, underserved are any populations that really do not have much access to STEM learning opportunities. They are not being well served. It may be because they live in rural areas and there aren't science centers or there aren't after-school programs that are provided. Underrepresented generally refers to minority or ethnic groups that are underrepresented in science, technology, math, engineering fields. Typically in our society, we know relatively few Hispanics, for example, are represented in those career paths. So those are the distinctions I generally think of. And gender can also be both underserved in some cases, women, girls, for example, but typically women are underrepresented, particularly, for example, in the area of physics.
And if you go to NSF.gov and you search on underrepresented, there are some formal definitions. That we, NSF does not have a formal definition of underserved.
Okay. Thanks very much.
The operator, are there any other questions?
I'm showing no other questions at this time.
All right. Well, we'd like to thank you for joining us for this webinar. We will have one more, Webinar 101. That will be on November 12th. It's basically a repeat. It is a repeat of this. We will be posting webinars, a webinar, and the transcript and questions from the entire set of webinars around November 20th. We will also have Webinar 102 on November 21st and December 3rd. So we hope you all will join us for those. And with that, thank you, Dennis, thank you, Wynn, and thank you, Sandy. And thank you all for participating.
And thank you, Ellen.
This does conclude the conference for today. All participants may disconnect at this time. Thank you.